Okay, ladies and gentlemen and everyone, thank you for joining us for today's webinar. My name is Kerry McDonald. I'm the UUA's Director of Youth and Young Adult Ministries. Can everybody hear me? Can folks hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Well, great. So thank you for coming today for this transracial youth adoption webinar. You should have been reminded when you joined this call that it is being recorded, so please know that. And our hope is to be able to make it available to folks who were unable to join us today. In fact, as some of you may know, this call was this webinar was so popular that we actually added another session tomorrow. So we were well oversubscribed. But we tried to keep this today to a manageable size so that we can have some discussion after Monica goes through her presentation. So I just wanted to start with a very brief reading. This one is in the spirit of what we try to achieve when we gather together. And so this is from our gray hymnal, and it's called To Risk by Anonymous. To laugh is to risk appearing the fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out for another is to risk exposing our true self. To place our ideas, our dreams, before the crowd is to risk loss. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To hope is to risk despair. To try is to risk failure. To live is to risk dying. And may we be there to support one another on our risky life journeys. So I'd like to start by introducing Reverend Dr. Monica Cummings, the UUA's Program Associate for Youth and Young Adults of Color. And then maybe, Monica, I'll turn it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Kerry, and welcome, everyone. And I don't know if people were muted when they come on, but if you wouldn't mind muting your phone until you're ready to speak, and that'll help cut down on the background noise.
Can you tell us how to mute?
You can press star 6 if you don't have that button on your phone.
Okay, our objectives for our webinar today are to learn the fundamentals of ministry with transracially adopted youth, articulate and process any discomfort or comfort we have discussing ethnic, racial, identity development, and learn about sharing resources. Wow, there's a baby with us. And so you can either type responses into the chat area that I believe is the right-hand lower side of the computer screen, or you can unmute yourself and respond to this question. So the question is, why is it important for faith leaders to learn about the ministry needs of transracially adopted children and youth? Why is it important for us to learn about the ministry needs of transracially adopted children and youth? And Kerry, would you help me with
what folks are...
Yeah, Monica, I'd be happy to. I think that ministry to transracially adopted youth is something that has been called for in public ways and in private ways. Two of the documents that we consider very important in shaping our work at the UUA are the 2009 Youth Ministry Working Group Report and the 2009 Mosaic Project Report for supporting youth and young adults of color. And both of those named transracially adopted youth as an underserved demographic within Unitarian Universalism. A significant percentage of UU youth of color are in fact transracially adopted, and so the needs, the specific needs of that group beyond just the needs of adopted youth and beyond the needs of youth of color at that intersection is something that we are working on serving better. So this webinar is in response to that, to those calls that we've heard. And clearly the response, I said this has been oversubscribed, so clearly there is a lot of need for providing support for religious professionals in their ministry to this group.
Thanks, Carrie. Would anyone else like to respond to the question, why is it important for us to learn about the ministry needs of transracially adopted children and youth? Anyone else? And again, you can type your response in the chat area that's in the lower right-hand corner of your computer screen, or you can unmute yourself and give a response. Okay, someone wrote, because there are transracially adopted children and youth in Indian communities, the well-being of the whole community improves when all are ministered to and with. Okay. Because there are children, our families, our siblings. Okay, great. Anyone else? Okay, great responses. So here are some more questions for us to process. And they speak to your comfort level talking about this topic. And so the first question I ask you is, are you comfortable talking about your race or ethnicity? What's your comfort level talking about your race or ethnicity?
And Monica, I think I'm right in saying that we're hoping this will be an interactive call, so folks should feel free to jump in response to some of these questions.
Thank you, Carrie. And again, you can respond by writing in the chat area, the lower right-hand corner of your computer monitor, or you can unmute yourself.
This is Megan Salby. Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay. I grew up in YUU and was politicized in the UU youth movement. And a big part of that politicization process for me was white identity development in youth and young adult communities. And I think because of a lot of the time spent, talking with my peers about what it means to do racial justice work as a white person and what white privilege means and all that, I feel a lot more comfortable, I think, talking about race than I certainly used to at, before going through that work.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Would anyone else like to respond to this first question?
This is Shonda O'Donnell Day Ramirez. I'm calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. I don't know how to mute myself, so I can't unmute, but you can tell me how to mute, and I'll remute after I share.
Okay.
I think I have varying degrees of comfort depending on who I'm talking with.
Okay.
And what setting I'm in, and I found myself just this weekend speaking with the only transracially adopted youth in our youth group and letting her know that I was going to participate and that I wanted to support her in any way that I could. And I just noted the awkwardness around starting that conversation.
Okay. Okay. And to mute yourself, press star 6 on your phone.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is John, and I think it really depends on the setting.
Okay.
Like Chandra was saying, being white, I know that I have privilege that I didn't ask for, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I can feel uncomfortable talking to people who of other races who wind up with some disadvantage in society that's
mm-hmm.
not their fault.
Okay. Thank you. So one of the things when we start looking at providing ministry to transracially adopted youth and children is we have to look at ourselves and our comfort level in terms of how comfortable we are with our identity. And that leads me to the next question. Are you comfortable talking to other people about their race or ethnicity? So what's your comfort level when you're talking with someone else about their race or ethnicity? And again, you can write in the chat area that's at the lower right-hand corner of your computer monitor, or you can start fixing on yourself.
This is Ellen Culpepper. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I am in Bloomington, Illinois, and I happen to interact with about a dozen young adults. I myself am 60, and I interact with about a dozen young adults who interact across black-white racial lines a lot. Some mm-hmm. of them are married to people of the other race and so forth. For people who are doing a lot of that kind of mingling, it's a lot easier to interact in a relaxed way about their race, my race. It's a little bit harder when I interact with people who are more deeply surrounded by folks of their own race and less often sort of cross into a sort of mingling area.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. And someone wrote, relatively comfortable. This has come in direct relationship to increased comfort talking about my own race and the way that race impacts my life as well as my understanding of systemic racism. Okay. Okay. And so that leads us to our third question. Have you engaged in racial ethnic identity work? So, again, join the conversation, please. This is meant, as Carrie said, to be a totally interactive, participatory experience. And so please join the conversation. And if you have engaged in racial ethnic identity work, let us know what that's been. Okay, someone wrote, I have situational comfort sometimes depending on the age. It seems older to talk to adults than kids. Okay. Okay.
This is Annie. I'm Annie Scott, and I'm from Oregon City, Oregon. And in response to the question, have you engaged in racial ethnic identity work, the answer is yes. I belong to the Joseph Priestley District Journey Toward Wholeness transformation team back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I belong to the Liberal Religious Educators Association integrity team, which was it's an anti-oppression group working with Loretta.
Okay.
And I feel pretty comfortable talking about my own racial ethnic identity and comfortable talking with other people about theirs, given that it's a sort of culturally uncomfortable topic.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Okay.
This is Alex in Buffalo. I'd like to think that I feel comfortable speaking with people of all races, but being Caucasian, I definitely do. There are times when I think a little bit more about what exactly I'm going to say to be politically correct sometimes in situations when maybe I wouldn't if I was speaking to only Caucasian people. So I guess I feel comfortable, but there's definitely a second thought now and then.
Okay. Okay.
Hello.
Yeah.
How do I get? Am I? This is Sonia in Buffalo.
You.
Oh, okay.
This is Sonia
in Buffalo, and I actually participated in a group in Syracuse, New York, when I used to live there. Dialogues on Racism, where we did talk. Mm. It was an intentionally mixed group of people brought together through Interfaith Works there, which gave me an opportunity to talk, and it really helped us to kind of break open some of those fears. One of the fears I frequently felt was that my intentions in talking about race were always good, but I was always afraid that I was going to either try too hard and be, you know, obnoxious, you know, and laughable, or to stumble and say something ignorant that I didn't realize was even racist because it's just so, you know, enculturated into us as we grow up. So my awkwardness lies more in the fear of getting it wrong so much more so than in really wanting to, you know, that's the main thing. It's the fear of getting it wrong, the fear of either assuming I know more than I do about a culture and I'm over-eager to prove that I'm, you know, that I understand, or to be a little too shy about it and not talk enough. So it's kind of a mixed feeling there, a little awkwardness, even though I've done work. It was an 8-week session in where we really had some wonderfully facilitated cross dialogue, and here at our church we're actually looking to do, we have a group of people who want to do work particularly on this issue of transracially adopted, multi-ethnic, multiracial families. So I'm really eager to see what we can learn here today.
Okay, great. And I think that's normal what it can share. Some of the discomfort comes from not wanting to say anything offensive or possibly, you know, stupid, not wanting to either showing that you don't know as much as you would like to know. So it's understandable people have discomfort around this topic, and it's always good, in my opinion, to talk about it, to process it. So, one, you know what you're feeling and what you're thinking. It's pretty normal, so you're not alone in thinking. Like, I don't want to engage in certain conversations with certain people because I don't want to say something offensive or I don't want to sound stupid. So knowing that you're not the only person that feels that way, I hope, makes you feel better, and I hope it also encourages you to continue to find opportunities and continue to find ways to have these discussions and conversations with people, and also to continue learning about your own racial ethnic identity as you try to work with youth who have been transracially adopted. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Great. And Carrie, if I missed anything that's written in the chat area, could you help me out with that, please?
Yeah, I'll be happy to, Monica. I'll keep an eye on that.
Okay.
We had one more, just a few more comments in the chat area about folks who had been involved in Laredo-level events and towards wholeness workshops, Jubilee and some other churches, and folks who engaged in personal reflection on their identity and how they interact with their community.
Okay. Thank you. Good stuff. And I want to commend y'all for being vulnerable and sharing some of this personal stuff, because I know it's got to be difficult. You know, I know it's always difficult for me to admit when I don't know, or to admit things about myself that you know, I think I should be more enlightened than I am. So I really thank you for being vulnerable and sharing what you're sharing. One of the things I learned as I started doing research and work around transracial and transnational adoption was just looking at adoption, period, and going back and looking at some of the history of adoption and talking with people and getting a better understanding from people about adoption, both people who have given children up for adoption and also people who have adopted. So I always, when I work with people, I always try to get them to see where their buttons may be or where tender spots may be for them when they're engaging and doing any kind of ministry or pastoral care. So one of the things that that I'd like us to process is, what assumptions do you live with concerning adoption? Like, so what are some of the assumptions you have around adoption? I see your names in the participant area. I'll start calling on people. All right, we got some action.
Well, I'll say I'm Ellen in Bloomington again, and I myself adopted a child who was Caucasian, as I am, but he was deaf. And deafness is a culture. It's a culture which is very, very unsimilar to hearing people's culture in quite a number of ways. So I bring that cross-cultural, that transcultural adoption experience from my own life, and I expect that adoption is something that you work at all your life long. It's not something that you do, the baby comes home with you, and then you just melt like any other family, but rather it's a lifetime of a very particular kind of work.
Okay. Thank you. Indeed. Indeed it is.
Hi, this is Deanna, and I'm have a sister-in-law who adopted two African-American children, and I have to say, honestly, I had, like, feelings for them, thinking, gosh, they're not with their family, they're not with their culture or their ethnicity, and I just don't, you know, those feelings are there, and I'm acknowledging them, but they all seem to be doing really well, and it's a great family, so I think they're being, you know, very conscious of their decisions, but I still definitely had feelings about it.
Okay. As do a lot of social workers. And doing my research, one of the things I read was, I think it was the National Black Social Workers Organization who opposed what they called out-of-race adoption, for some of the reasons that were mentioned. And if you get an opportunity to do any reading around that, I highly encourage you to do so. And so we'll just go into the next question. So what are your feelings related to adoption?
Monica, I want to share some of the things that have been coming up in the chat screen.
Okay.
Someone shared that they think adoption is generally a painful experience. For everyone in participation. Some others, that parents have to have financial means, that it seems like a selfless act on behalf of parents, but, you know, there can be any number of fertility issues related to that decision. That children will someday have identity issues and questions, and that people would prefer to have their own children rather than adopt. That all adopted children will struggle with issues of rejection, anger, and identity, and confusion. And let me also note that there's a question here about recommended books, and just to keep you paying attention through the whole webinar, we do have some resources at the end to recommend books.
Indeed we do.
This is Sonia in Buffalo. We actually started a group for transracial adoption kids and kids from multiracial families, and what we're finding from at least what the parents are saying, though, is that a lot of times these kids are not struggling with the identity issues as much as we would think. We have a fairly large population in this church of kids who come from multiple ethnic backgrounds, and that the bigger reason why they're not struggling as much is because the communities that they're in are basically browning, in that there are fewer and fewer people who are of any one quote-unquote pure racial background anymore, because everybody's kind of cross-mirroring and cross-mixing, and so it's just so much more common now for families to have diversity within them that there's less stigma attached to it anymore.
That is not a cross-the-board normal experience.
Okay, yeah. Maybe it's because we're in the city we're in. But.
Oh, yeah. I live in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and that is not the experience here for transracially adopted children and youth, as well as other parts of the country. So,
I was surprised to hear that, because I expected to hear more more struggle than the parents in this church were reporting. Now, if we were talking more to the kids, we may hear a different story, though.
And we're going to get to that, and one of the suggestions that's going to be made when we get the tips for religious professionals, we're going to talk about some of the things that can advantage transracially adopted children and their families. But we'll get there. Okay.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Beth. I'm actually a transracial adoptive mom.
Okay.
And I think one of the things that I've learned, or that's, I think, going to help me, my son's only two right now, I'm really just listening in to try to learn some things,
okay.
Is that the youth and children now are really kind of a second generation of transracially adopted children,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a lot more resources for parents.
Mm-hmm.
To do a better job, to be aware that we need to, you know, pay attention to race,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, not be colorblind. And I think that may be where it's a little less challenging even in communities that are less diverse, that we're aware that, you know, identity issues can be a problem, where I think, you know, a generation ago, that really wasn't considered.
So where are you located again?
I'm in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, okay. Okay. Thank you. So I think this next question, what assumptions do you live with concerning transracial adoption, and what are your feelings related to transracial and transnational adoption? I think they've been kind of covered, but if one or two people want to comment on this, feel free to go for it. Any assumptions you live with concerning transracial adoption or feelings related to transracial or transnational adoption? Okay.
This is Shonda in Northampton again. I think because of situations that I'm privy to in terms of the social circles and whatnot, I think I would think that the babies and children that I've seen adopted transnationally are coming from difficult circumstances in terms of financial means or in terms of violence or displacement, and that there's an opportunity to move into, you know, more security on many levels with the transnational adoption.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. One more person.
This is Annie Scott again. I think that part of what's in my kind of bag of stewing is that, you know, I've known a bunch of people who have adopted transracially, transnationally, and
mm-hmm.
At least, I don't know, maybe three have had some really serious problems. You know, one of them was the child... one of the kids ended up being very, very emotionally disturbed. Another one visited the home, the other country of the adopted child as a teenager, and it was a very traumatic experience. And so it sort of raised these questions of should it have even happened in the first place, except
mm-hmm.
that the woman, the young woman was a baby, she was in a really very, very difficult situation. So I you know, part of what I bring is just really, really mixed feelings and questions. You know, it just feels so complicated. It feels I have trouble kind of teasing out what ought to be.
And that's good that you're aware that you have complicated feelings around that. So when you're providing ministry or working with either parents or folks who've been transracially adopted, you're aware of where your tender spots are.
Right, right.
And so that stuff doesn't come out that could possibly cause more harm. Okay.
Right.
And so part of this webinar is to help people, is to provide some resources and possibly some answers. You know, and the other really important piece is to help people understand where their tender spots are, where their buttons are, and that will then be areas that you know where you need to do some work as you move forward providing pastoral care and or ministry to this population.
Monica, this is Carrie. I just want to jump in and say that while we were doing research for this webinar, close to half of the resources we came across were actually concerning those types of questions about ethical issues related to transracial or transnational adoption. And just to hold those up as really important issues, but not necessarily issues that the youth, that is a decision of the youth themselves. They, you know, don't necessarily have a choice of what happens to them as little children. And so, you know, that goes back to the earlier, where we started, which is about the processing that we as adults who minister and work with youth do on the front end. And to say that those are legitimate issues and they exist side by side with all, with the work that we do with youth.
Thank you.
This is Annie Scott again. Can I just add one other kind of uncomfortable feeling I have? And that's that, I mean, I identify as European American, and I think that I bring some sort of suspicion to white adoptive parents who have chosen to adopt transracially, transnationally. Some sort of suspicion about, I don't know. I mean, I'm not even sure I know quite what it is, but, you know, kind of do-gooder, help the downtrodden. I mean, I don't know quite what it is all, but as we're talking, I was just kind of becoming aware that I definitely have some kind of prejudice about the skepticism.
Okay, and so being aware of that, you know when you're talking with parents, white parents who have adopted trans, you know that that's there.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm sure you also know that you'll be more helpful to them, helping them to fill in the gaps or fill in some of the growing edges that they have around the adoption, if they did adopt for reasons that cause you to be suspicious. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Monica, a couple more questions from the feed here. Something included that it was the parent's goal to adopt transracially or transnationally, as opposed to that's what came through the process. That parents of transnationally adopted children may be more likely to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, so not your heteronormative standard couple. A couple folks commented on that, noting that in most of the cases when we're talking about transracial adoptions, we assume that the parents are Caucasian. So those are some of the things in the comments.
Okay. Good stuff. So here's a question for you. What tells you a child or youth of color is adopted? Right, how do you know?
There are lots of times that you don't. Like if you're just shopping out in a mall or in a large store or something, you have no idea whether the child of color sitting in the basket or walking along beside a parent or grandparent is adopted or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If they're members of our congregation, I guess I make the assumption if they look or really different before they have shared the facts with me.
Okay.
I was recently, this is Shonda again in Northampton, I was recently walking for a social justice activity with some youth, and we started talking about how complicated families are and how important it is not to make assumptions about how any family came to be formed. And I'm the mother of a multiracial, bicultural daughter, and I've had other children say, oh, she's brown, you're white, you're her mom. You know, and children say stuff like that because they're not inculcated to stay quiet when they notice differences like that, but certainly a button for me personally in terms of the makeup of my own family, and helps me to remember, you know, with any families, that there's often stories, and we don't know how any family came to be. My stepfather and I were once told how much we looked alike, and how awkward a moment is that when we're not biologically related. I think it's a place where we need to bring a lot of sensitivity.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Hi, this is Julie from Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, Julie.
Hi. And I agree with the last comment that you really can't make assumptions. I inherited a niece 18 years ago, and she does not look like, you know, my husband at all. And my biological children look like him, and she actually looks like me.
Mm-hmm.
We are a blended family. And also the comment about it truly is a lifelong endeavor when you do it.
Yeah. And so you'll see the word assumption coming up in this webinar. And that, as you start looking at where your buttons are, where your tennis spots are, we also want you to look at your assumptions and what assumptions you're making when you see a family or when you see a child or youth in your program. What assumptions are you making at first glance without having any information or facts to back up what it is you're thinking?
This is Sonia in Buffalo, and one of the areas where we were challenged on that, there was a woman who came to be on this multi-identity committee, and the assumption, of course, was that she was an African-American woman. She was tall, very dark, very lovely. But then she very sweetly pointed out that she was neither African nor American. She was born in the West Indies and raised in Great Britain, and therefore really that any assumptions we were making based on her appearance were wrong. And and she also had married an Italian man and has a son with him, and so the child actually calls himself a child of the islands because it's Sicily and Ireland and Jamaica that he identifies with. So, so it was just kind of a strange situation where she really made a point for us of those assumptions.
Yes. So looking at our assumptions and to add on to what's been said, especially around youth who are biracial or multi-ethnic, and a lot of times when they're out with their family, you know, people assume that if the child does have a different skin color or texture of hair, they will question whether or not that child is the birth child of the parent. And so looking at our assumptions, so what feelings come up for you when you're processing and possibly making assumptions when you see a child or when you see a family? Like, what are some of the things you're feeling in terms of trying to figure out who or what this family unit is?
Well, I think that's a good point about sometimes you do think, oh, the child may be from a divorce rather than adoption sometimes.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else? What are the feelings that come up for you when you see families, when it's families or families and one person in the family looks different from other members of the family? What are some of the feelings that come up for you?
Well, this is Alex in Buffalo. I work at an adoption agency, and
okay.
I know that there are times when I see a Caucasian family and maybe a child that is Asian or African or American, and I immediately think, I wonder if they're adopted, and that's generally the first thing that comes to my mind, and that I don't know if that's good, bad, or, but that's generally, because where I work, what's on my mind most of the day, that's generally one of my first thoughts.
Okay.
One of the places, this is Ellen from Bloomington, Illinois, one of the places I see blended families most frequently involves grandparents out with children of color, white grandparents out with children of color. I never assume the child is adopted, and I think that my unconscious assumption is that that grandparent has, they always look very relaxed and warm toward the child, and I assume that grandparent is on quite an adventure in grandparenting because of the complexities of grandparenting anybody in this day and age, and then adding in multiculturalness to the mix.
Okay.
This is Megan in Chicago. I have been reading a lot more about, on a national scale, how adoptions are happening and related to racial justice work, and that especially now around immigration stuff, that there are a lot more adoptions happening in Latino families because of roundups of people who look like they might be undocumented immigrants. And just thinking about how that is a large percent of current adoptions in foster care in the U.S. right now. And then thinking about the other main sources of why adoption is so needed and how it's related to the prison industrial complex and parents who are caught up in prisons and legal battles. So I think it makes it that much more important that we understand those issues as well to figure out how it's affecting people at all angles of the adoption process.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Monica, let's share a couple things from the comment stream. Just that a little bit of a discussion about the difference in generations and how currently transracial adoptions, one person related that can be pretty mixed in their congregation, and kids who adopted by a Latina mom and an Asian mom, an African American child. Somebody noted that they have a brother who's biracial and transracially adopted, and that people would always assume that they were boyfriend and girlfriend when they were teens, and that was a painful experience. And I, on a personal level, I, as someone who's biracial, has definitely been asked that question and had that assumption made about me in the past. Other questions about whether folks should ask and what kind of reaction transracially adopted child might have, whether they get bullied about it, and just someone else noting how being mixed families, multiracial families, can be affirming for those, especially who live in multiracial families, and seeing that there are more ways to define what family looks like.
Yeah, and we have a slide for that will talk about some of the things that families can do in order to support themselves and their transracial adopted children. All good stuff, folks. And so now we're going to move into your ministry setting or your professional setting. And so one of the questions is, and someone, I think, Carrie, you just mentioned someone writing in, you know, how do you ask? And so a step before that is to look at what is your relationship with the child or the youth. And so what type of relationship do you have with children and youth in your congregation who you know are transracially adopted? And the question is asked because it's easier, as you all probably know, it's easier to provide ministry and to support with pastoral care when a relationship is established before some type of identity crisis or some type of encounter, a negative encounter around identity happens. If a trusting relationship has been formed before the event. So those of you who are in congregations or whatever your ministry setting is, what type of relationship do you have with youth and children in your ministry setting who are transracially adopted?
This is Julie, and we have 6 children that are adopted in our program out of about 65 children.
Okay.
And I think it's helped. I'm the DRE here, and I think it's helped because I had an adopted child myself.
Okay.
So right from the get-go, the parents and the children connected with me.
Okay.
I had an easier time with it because of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else want to share what type of relationship they have?
Well, this is Ellen from Bloomington. I have just moved from one church to another, but I have been minister in a church that had a bunch of mixed race families. No adoptions in that case. However, I found it was really helpful if I would begin relationships with the children and the families by simply selecting to eat at their table for a fellowship event. Start really, really low-key, just the kind of chit-chat where you're finding out what the kid likes in school, if they're old enough to be in school, and just mm-hmm. kind of relating to them in a very, very easygoing way, and then take it forward a step at a time from that.
Okay. Thank you. And by doing that, you also get to know what their interests are. So, again, you know, the next Sunday during coffee hour or whatever opportunities you have to spend time is to then find out what their interests are. Do they enjoy music? Do they enjoy playing a musical instrument? Are they into sports? Just ways to start dialoguing and building a relationship with the hopes, because a young adult who grew up in our movement shared with me the identity crisis he went through as a transracially adopted male of African descent in our UU churches. And one of the things he said, he wished he had someone to talk to, and not about the deep stuff, but someone just to talk to about some of the interests he had as a way for him to then develop trust in this adult, that he could have then shared with this person some of the identity challenges that he was going through, but he didn't have any adults in his world, in his UU world, who he had a relationship with, who he could trust, talking about deep issues, because he didn't have those relationships with people to talk about, you know, his hobbies or other interests. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
Okay.
I'd like to add one other comment back to Ellen in Bloomington. I kept on purpose a pretty big row of children's books featuring heroes and heroine children from all different races. I mean, it was a really, really multiracial row of children's books. So as a kid would happen by my office, there would be things in their interest level, and they would very quickly see that I did not think of people as one kind of race. They they could pick out books to browse through that were related to their birth race. They could kind of talk about some of the issues, because that was just really a visible sign of my openness.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. Carrie, is there anything in the chat area that...
Let's see. Folks have noted that some parents aren't forthcoming with details because they think their children might be treated differently. Another point that's coming up is about kids with disabilities. Someone noted that in that circle we have a concept called people first language. Actually, disability is something that I'm glad has come up. We in advertising for this webinar, we heard from a family who noted that they had transracially adopted children, and that one of their children had some pretty severe disabilities, those issues can coexist alongside any number of other issues related to race in our congregations, related to adoption and what it means to grow up as an adopted child, and just to note that sometimes those things are layered on top of that and can be challenges for churches, congregations, RE programs, youth groups, to figure out how to navigate in a way that affirms everyone's humanity and is but it's respectful and realistic. So, there's also a question about the timeline here, and I apologize for not noting that earlier. We had planned this to be a 90-minute webinar, and so the goal is to finish up by 5:30, I hope you can stick around until then.
Thanks, Gary. And so, in doing research around this topic, one of the things that I learned is the issue around people thinking that their parenting is being questioned. And so not only do we need to look at our relationship with children and youth who have been transracially adopted, we also need to look at our relationship with their parents. And that's where the ministry team relationship really comes into play. The minister and the religious educator or the religious professionals working as a team to support this family. So some of the questions that can be challenging for us as we do this ministry is gauging parents' openness to talking about race and ethnicity and not assuming that parents who have adopted transracially are open to dialoguing about ethnicity and race, or are open to being involved in programming or supporting programming that talks about or educates people about transracial adoption. So if one or two, three people could share, you know, what is your relationship with parents or guardians who have adopted transracially, and what has been your experience in terms of parents either being open to talking about race and ethnicity, or parents who someone mentioned earlier about being colorblind, that they just want to raise their child as their child and not paying special attention to the fact that this child has a different ethnicity than the rest of the family.
This is Julie again. Since we have 6 adopted children in our program and there's 4 sets of parents, I would say 2 of the sets of parents are very open, forthcoming, talked about the process, and then 2 of them are completely quiet about it.
Mm-hmm.
One, I mean, a father and a mother, and one the mother doesn't come at all, but the father brings the adopted children to church and is never said a word and cannot be engaged in a conversation about it.
Okay.
Kind of a mixture for us.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else want to share their experience in trying to engage parents for understanding their
This is Annie Scott from Oregon again. We have an adoptive group, adoptive parents group in our church, not just transracial, transnational, but adoptive parents.
Okay.
And there's been a fairly open dialogue, I think, in that group about it. My relationships vary, as the last person said. Some parents are really open, and we have kind of an ongoing conversation about it. And other people haven't brought it up to me, and I guess I've been sort of hesitant. The newer they are, the more hesitant I am to dive in. But often people who are new, when they see how many children of variety of races and families with a variety of ethnicities, are reassured by having a community that has a variety of kids in it.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
This is Shonda in Northampton again. I just want to bring up the issue of youth because I'm involved specifically in youth group and youth ministry, and my allegiance is to youth, and my relationship isn't the same as folks who are working with smaller children in terms of ongoing and more frequent contact with parents. So I'm just kind of throwing my question mark into the air in terms of how to relate to parents of children who are gaining independence.
Okay. Could you say more about that, please?
I guess we're dedicated to creating, you know, a safe space for youth and and also to holding youth confidentiality.
Okay.
So I support parents to meet with each other in an ongoing way, but I'm not part of their meetings. They meet concurrently with youth group, and I'm part of the youth process.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering about how parents fit in when my work is there's a commitment to youth confidentiality and youth space, understanding, you know, growing identity and independence.
Okay. And we're going to get to that when we get to the slide, tips for parents, things that you can do to help parents support their children.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay.
You know, that's an interesting question. This is Sonia from Buffalo. Because we did run this movie Off and Running, which was a point of view special about a transracial adoption, and one of the youth was there who really did talk about her feelings, and they sounded very different than the presentation that the mom had about how the family was operating. And then there is that kind of sense of, well, what do you do if you find out that the kids are having problems, but that the parents think everything's, you know, fine and dandy and isn't it all great, it's working perfectly.
Yeah.
And what do you do to help in that situation?
And my work actually started, thanks for sharing that, when I applied to start working on my doctorate, I actually applied to study conflict in nonprofits, so I could work with churches. And then I went to GA Fort Worth, 2005. And for those of you who were not at that GA, GA Fort Worth, there were, of course, a number of workshops. One workshop was a workshop on transracial adoption, but they called it transracial adoption. That the people were abducted, not adopted. And And some of the young people there, it was a panel discussion, some of the young people who participated, as the person who just spoke mentioned, shared about their experiences, which were very painful, and their parents had not heard that, and the parents got very upset, and the workshop ended really badly. And then it spun off from there, where young people then got really angry because they thought they were being shut down by adults after they, you know, got the courage to actually share their lived experience and not what people wanted to hear about their experience or what was really going on with them. And so after that experience, that was painful for everyone who was there experiencing it, I started looking at our movement and what type of support were we providing to children and youth of color, period. But in particular, what were we doing to support transracially adopted youth and children and their parents? So as someone just mentioned, so parents are aware of the experiences that their children are having and not making assumptions about the experiences that children are having. And so there's challenges around that also, because if a child comes home repeatedly and talks about, one, if the white parent is not doing any work around their identity, they're not going to be aware of how different people of color are treated. So, for example, if a child comes home from school and says the teacher either never calls on them or the teacher treats them differently than the other students, if the parent says you're misunderstanding, you may not be paying attention, if the parent's not plugging in and saying, here's my child of color, and this child's telling me I'm being treated differently, if the parent isn't going to investigate that and possibly validate that experience for their child, what happens after the child experiencing this over and over again, they're just going to say, my parent doesn't understand, so I'm going to stop sharing. But the experiences don't stop. But the child's not communicating with the parent about what's going on. So then that disconnect happens when something horrible happens, and then the parent's made aware of the situation, and then coming to the realization that my child's been having all these negative experiences, and I wasn't aware of it. Does that make sense?
This is Karen. Let me also just jump in to say that anyone who works with youth is no stranger to the idea of crises coming up in youth lives that parents don't have much of a clue about. And so there are, you know, a number of ways to work out questions around confidentiality, but something that I think is important to recognize is the same principle that we were talking about in terms of religious professionals, which is that it's better to create an environment in which these issues can arise and that youth feel okay to bring them up before there's something that happens.
Yeah.
And so being able to, you know, just ask if those things come up for parents with their youth and so that the parents have some support too. If they get kinds of questions that they know that they can maybe use the staff at the church, leaders at the church as a resource for if and when those things arise with their children. So reaching out beforehand in a proactive way, not an accusatory way, or in a way that potentially violates confidentiality,
yeah,
is another option.
And it goes back to building relationships.
This
yeah.
is Sonia from Buffalo again. One of the other concerns that I have is, can we overpush the point where it's like, you've got youth who are involved and they are pretty much happy, and can we do, you know, harm or create an awkwardness if we bring up the issue too directly, too strongly, in a way that makes the transracially adopted kids feel kind of singled out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, gee, you must be having a hard time with this. Well, what if they're not, or what if they are and they don't want to talk about it? I mean, is there, it feels like there's, while we want to do supportive things, I fear that in our good intentions we could also create a problem where there isn't one. Or
totally understandable, and that's why the relationship building is important. That's why finding out what the child or youth's interests are. And so in casual conversation, you know, you're talking, you're building a relationship, and again, not assuming that everything is going well, and not assuming that there's problems, but developing a relationship so if the child or youth is going through anything, that you're an adult who they feel comfortable and they trust coming to you and talking with you. And we're going to get to a slide where I suggest that we do identity work across generations. So white youth need to work on white identity, youth of color need to work on their identity, as well as transracially adopted youth need to work on their identity. And so it's not singling out one youth. However, it is about building relationships. So if there are issues going on, my challenge to ministers and religious educators is that if youth can't talk about these issues at home, if they can't talk about them in school, church needs to be the place that they come that they can talk about this stuff. And that'll happen once relationships are built and trust is established. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And so, remember, this process is not about you. And again, you know, if you have discomfort around adoption, if you have discomfort around talking about your ethnic racial identity or talking with people about theirs, remember, it's not about you and that you possibly have work to do. You know, another challenge is understanding, like someone said, this is a process. It's not an event. You know, so, you know, great if a child gets to go to Korean culture camp or gets to do other, you know, Chinese New Year celebrations. That's great. It's great to if you have at least one class in identity development, but one program or one experience is not enough. It needs to be an ongoing process. And another challenge is, you know, just understanding, you know, issues that are related to normal stages of development, especially when we're talking about adolescents and youth, you know, trying to untangle, you know, what's normal developmental stage stuff and what's maybe behavioral issues or attitude issues that are related to adoption and how they can manifest and seem similar and be tangled together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah, so, you know, when we're talking, especially talking about adolescents and youth, we all know they're going through some serious developmental issues. You know, and it goes with addiction, it goes with LGBTQ, all identities. You know, we have to be careful when youth are at that age where developmentally, you know, they've got hormones that are going, you know, wacky and things, to not assume or read too much in, but again, having built relationship with them, understanding, you know, what's developmental stuff, what's addiction, or what's adoption related, you know, and if these things are all tangled together. All right, so just be aware of that. When you're working with youth, this is an additional challenge. All right, so ministry in action. So one of the things you can do is provide identity development education across generations. That includes parents, that includes grandparents, and, of course, that includes the youth. Create a safe environment where youth feel comfortable talking about their identity. Again, you know, it's building that relationship and building up the trust. And I think someone mentioned, do not assume that all transracially adopted youth have the same experience. You know, some youth may be in a family where they're talking about race and ethnicity, where they're talking about difference, where they're talking about all this stuff, and that youth will probably have a different attitude and different mindset than a youth who's in a family where none of that stuff's being talked about and they're not being exposed to anything related to their identity to help them build a positive self-identity. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay.
Monica, this is Carrie. I want to jump in to just really underline that point, and that when we think about youth ministry, we often think about dealing with crisis situations as they arise. But I was having a conversation with some friends of the family who have two transracially adopted children, one from Nepal and one from Cambodia, and I was asking them about, we were talking, and I said, "Have you ever thought about those things?" And it hadn't really come up for them. They didn't think so in their own lives, and that especially if we're doing our jobs well and we're raising well-adjusted UU children in our safe congregations, that it's entirely possible that that youth will not feel confronted with these issues necessarily in 10th grade or 11th grade. Sometimes it may take until you're out of that safe environment and have an encounter in another part of the world, maybe after high school or in college. For some folks, this won't come up until their 20s. But that doesn't mean that there's an easy way out of doing your own learning and understanding about your identity. And for some youth, I'm sure that they avoid these types of questions because it doesn't seem like there's the space for them to explore that. And So in building a relationship, you can normalize that kind of conversation in such a way, if we as adults are comfortable to a certain degree, that space opens up, and maybe that type of meaningful personal exploration can occur for youth who wouldn't otherwise have had that opportunity. You're really preparing, if we're being supportive, we're preparing youth for a lifetime of identity development and maturation, and I just want to make sure that we aren't just thinking about it in terms of a crisis resolution mentality.
Thanks, Gary. Okay, here's some helpful tips for parents. Mindful of our time together is getting short. So helpful tips for parents, and you can put this. You can write a newsletter column for your church or organizational newsletter about the stuff. There is a National Adoption Month, and if you want to lift up adoption, talk about adoption during that month. But here's some tips that you can share with parents, and that is to encourage children to acknowledge and discuss their racial heritage with you, the parent, as well as other significant individuals. Acknowledge that their child's ethnic racial heritage is different from their own, and recognize that as a positive. So difference doesn't mean bad. There's no value to it. It's a positive thing to have a different ethnic racial identity. Give their child opportunities to develop relationships with peers from many different backgrounds by allowing them to attend integrated schools and by living in integrated neighborhoods. And someone mentioned earlier that their community is very diverse, and the transracially adopted children in that congregation don't seem to be having issues, which would make sense if they look through the congregation, if they look throughout their neighborhood, if they go to school, and there are people who look like them. Chances are they are able to develop a positive self-identity, as opposed to children who wake up in the morning, no one looks like them. They walk to school through their neighborhood, no one looks like them, and they get to school, and no one looks like them. They probably have a different experience about their identity and what it means to always be different. Allow the child to meet role models through participation in social activities held by support groups. And this is, and this last point is highlighted. One of my kitties is joining us. He's up from his afternoon nap. Form a family identity as an interracial unit. And I highlighted that point because I think it's really important for families to use language that lifts up the fact that, yes, we are an interracial, a multicultural, multi-ethnic family unit, and that's a good thing. And here's some helpful tips for religious educators. Identify organizations in your area that are involved in transracial, transnational adoption, and some examples are, you can host speakers. You can ask a speaker from one of those organizations to come on a Sunday morning and do their Sunday morning programming,
or to do a workshop on a Sunday or whenever, have panel discussions, have people come in, you know, a multi-gen panel discussion, so you get a variety of experience and input, and hold other educational events. So education, education, education. Someone already mentioned help to, or you know, organizing a parent support group. So parents who have adopted transracially, transnationally, or it sounds like that group is just a group for parents who have adopted children. That way, parents have a place for a safe space for them to process their feelings and thoughts and what they're experiencing. And again, help to organize events for children and youth, so children and youth can socialize and interact with people who look like them, who are also their age. Okay, and so
Monica, let me just jump in and say there was a question from the chat about if you could share three specific examples of how to help new families know that a staff member or leader is approachable and the church is a safe environment for those types of discussions.
A newsletter column, write a, you know, adoption month, just say, hey, you know, National Adoption Month is coming up next month, and, you know, that way. Literature, have literature in your office visible. It's the same thing when I, about addiction, you know. So if someone in the congregation is struggling with any issue, LGBT, if you have literature that's visible, if you have books on your shelf and someone comes in and says, wow, she's got a book on transracial adoption, or she has this material, you know, you can write for your January newsletter column or you know, however you want to communicate it, like you participated in this webinar. You know, and that's one way people will know that you are actively engaged and processing this topic. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I always advocate have literature, books on your shelf, you know, pamphlets laying around. And again, inviting a speaker to come say, you know, we're going to organize this event and we're going to have a speaker come in on a Sunday morning or whenever, so people know that you're approachable and that you're involved and engaged and you care about transracial adoption.
Just another quick note, folks have asked about whether they can get copies of this presentation, and so we can email out the slides after this presentation. We have all your email addresses when you register.
And there's a book that I found really helpful that that she only spent like a paragraph, and I'll add this to the resources before we send it out to you. And it's called Primal Wound. And the author, who is also a therapist, her starting point when she has someone come into her practice, and regardless of what their presenting problem is, once she finds out that they've been adopted, she switches her focus of care to post-traumatic stress disorder. Her contention is that when a child is taken from the parent, it's a traumatic experience for the baby. And so that traumatic experience, she contends, is carried throughout their life. And so that kind of shifted how I thought about adoption, especially transracial adoption. And I'll add that book to the list as a resource, since we're starting to talk about resources. So we have 5 minutes left. I know that's not much time. Hopefully we were able to have a good enough dialogue as we went through the slides. But now, do you have questions or do you have resources that you would like to share?
This is Annie from Oregon again. I wonder about if there could be a workshop at this coming GA. I mean, I don't quite understand what the format is. I know it's much more action-oriented, but it seems so pertinent given that we're talking about immigration and such. to have some kind of workshop or opportunity for this kind of conversation at GA, I just think would be really, really helpful.
Okay.
Carrie? That's a great idea.
It is, and unfortunately, the deadline for making proposals, for those of you who haven't been following the ins and outs of the GA planning, they are still having planned up workshops as usual, but for them to be focused on immigration and on justice issues, and the number of workshops is lower, so fewer workshops. But they're evaluating proposals at the moment for workshops, and I can suggest to them that that might be something, if there isn't a proposal, that they might... that they might consider soliciting, so I'm happy to pass that on. Let me also note that in the chat, there was a PBS special called Off and Running that somebody recommended, and I don't know much about it, but that did come up.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Sonia from Buffalo. We were the ones who used that movie here. We are paired with an adoption agency to do a lot of our multiracial, multi-ethnic, and transracially adopted programming. And the executive director there brought this movie to us to share. And it's a very brief synopsis. It gets into a lot of the issues we talked about today. It was a story of a young woman in her teens kind of... moving into adulthood, who was an African-American gal who was raised by a Jewish lesbian couple, had a brother who was also mixed race, and was trying to contact her birth mother and just the experiences she was having around being adopted, around being black, about being Jewish, and about trying to claim her own identity and move out into the world on her own. And it was just so rich that it really had something for everyone in terms of the whole concept of becoming your own person. So it kind of hit a lot of what you were talking about today, and it did spark a very, very good conversation. And it comes with a curriculum that can be used with the class. So it's available through PBS.
Okay. And for those of you who aren't familiar with my work, I've developed... at this point, 4 animated videos that are geared toward youth that deal on various topics around identity, and I've also developed discussion guides to go with them. And probably beginning in late January, I will create an animated video based on this material, followed by a study guide. So that'll be an additional resource that's available, not only for youth and parents, but also for religious professionals.
Are your animated films available? Something we could get a hold of?
2 of them should be on UUA.org by tomorrow. It's White Identity Development and Ethnic Racial Identity Development for Youth with the discussion guide. And they're all on YouTube without the discussion guide.
Monica, this is Susan Lawrence, excuse me, I've been listening, I'm a staff person as well, and they are online, the White Identity and the Racial Ethnic Identity Formation for Youth of Color are both online with some good explanation up front in each of their discussion guides about appropriate settings for using them that might help you think through some alternate programming as well.
Okay, thank you, Susan.
We can send out links to those videos when we send the PowerPoint presentation as well.
Excellent, thank you.
All right, I think we may have time for one more question. All right, well, thank you. Thank you indeed for spending time with us this afternoon and for all the great feedback and your ministry with our young people. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you, Monica,
for your support.
Indeed, and I wish you all a safe and happy holiday season.
You too.
Thank you. Likewise.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you.
Carrie. Carrie.
He's gone.
He's gone.
No, there he is. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to call you out.